Thanks so much. 1 Kings chapter 10 will be our text today. 1 Kings chapter 10, a sermon and a text that I have entitled, All That Glitters. Several years ago, my family and I had a layover in London on our way to visit some mission partners in Africa, and so we took a few days to enjoy the city. One of our stops was the British Library, which you may know has a room called simply the Treasures Room. It's a collection of some of the world's most important and interesting documents. They have in the Treasures Room one of four remaining copies of Magna Carta, dating back to 1215. They have a Gutenberg Bible from 1455 with its ornate edges and the gilded edges of the paper and the ornate Latin lettering. They have an original folio of Handel's Messiah written in his own hand. They have sheet music from Bach and Beethoven, original lyric sheets handwritten by the Beatles themselves, all on display in the British Library Treasures Room, which you can tour for free. So it's a major attraction for families like ours. They have pages from Leonardo da Vinci's own notebook, written again in the great Renaissance man's hand, personal letters from Queens Elizabeth I and Bloody Mary. They have original work from Shakespeare and Charles Dickens and Jane Austen. They have in the British Library one of the most important biblical manuscripts ever discovered, one that you've been reading about since you began your theological education. Codex Sinaiticus is in the Treasures Room of the British Library. Dating all the way back to the mid-300s, the oldest copy bound in one book of the entire New Testament. That was the volume I had come to see. And it literally took my breath away as I stood there trying to describe to one of my sons the significance of this book in the history of Christianity and textual criticism. But just as I turned to go, a small book across the aisle caught my eye. It was another Bible. But this one was about one-fourth the size of these really large, ornate, other bound volumes. It was a Tyndale New Testament. One of only three in the world known to survive from 1526. I was looking in that book at the Word of God in my own language. The effect, the results of Tyndale's entire life's work, his labor of love to the English-speaking world, the book he literally lost his life to produce. I couldn't believe my eyes. But I turned and saw it right there, lying on a display case right before my very eyes, and I could read in English. It was a little hard to make out, but I could read in my own native tongue. In the beginning was that word, and that word was with God, and God was that word. Among all these other noteworthy artifacts and fascinating documents from Western culture, here in that little volume was a real treasure. A real treasure. And when it comes to the history of Western civilization, you could make a reasonable argument that it was the most influential treasure in that room for shaping our own culture, the Word of God in English. And yet, it probably was the greatest treasure in the British Library's Treasures Room, and yet only a few people stopped to even glance at it. They were way more interested in the Beatles than the Bible. It's a little bit of what's going on in 1 Kings 10. We're confronted with the question, what is the true treasure of the kingdom? We've come to the high water mark of Israel's glory, and to quote the great philosopher Calvin, not Calvin of Geneva, but Calvin of Hobbes, there's treasure everywhere in this chapter. It's hard to imagine Jesus was thinking of anything other than 1 Kings 10 when he said, Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these flowers of the field. And yet, as the old adage says, what goes up must come down, and it's nowhere more true than here. Careful readers begin to notice a tilt to this chapter. There's an alarming list affecting the ship of state, and it begins about halfway through. And it involves that all-important question, what is the real treasure of the kingdom? That halfway point marks these two sections of the chapter. You can look at it. It's pretty clear right before your very eyes. There are two seekers of glory in this chapter, a queen who came seeking wisdom and a king enamored with something else entirely. One was breathless with wonder, the other one was blinded by wealth. Both of them stood in the presence of treasure, but only one of them recognized where the real treasure lay. That's what's going on in this chapter. And guys, I've got to tell you, this is a passage that, as I've studied it, has spoken so deeply into my soul as a pastor. I'm so glad I get to share some of that with you. This is one of those passages perfectly suited to pastoral application and pastoral guilt, and I don't want that to happen. I don't want you to just feel the guilt from this. The gospel's sufficient for us here as it is in every other place. But I won't shy away from the application. Brothers, we handle holy things every week. And what happens when the living word just becomes work? When God's glory becomes just another word that you define, an abstraction that you discuss, but you may or may not experience? Solomon doesn't stop believing in God at his collapse. He just stops being enamored with God, and he becomes more enamored with the gifts. Ministry, especially when gifts are abundant, and the kingdom, I put that in quotes, we're not kings of a kingdom, but you know the analogy. Ministry, especially when the gifts are abundant and the kingdom is flourishing, can be a dangerous place for the soul, can't it? So let's look at these two parts of this passage. There's a queen who sees the real treasure and a king who most definitely does not. Verse 1, when the queen of Sheba heard of the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices, very much gold and precious stones. And when she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind. Don't miss, there are two attractions that draw her to Jerusalem. His fame is the first one. Chapter 9, verse 10 tells us Solomon's been on the throne for 20 years at this point, and if that has any bearing chronologically on this passage, he's halfway through his reign. His fame is starting to spread, in part probably, look at the end of chapter 9, because of the shipping business that he's gotten engaged in. Verse 26, King Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion-Geber, which is near Eloth, the shores of the Red Sea, the land of Edom, and Hiram sent with the fleet his servants, seamen who were familiar with the sea, together with the servants of Solomon. And they went to Ophir and brought from there gold, 420 talents, and they brought it to King Solomon. So Solomon's fame is spreading, probably through shipping, probably word of mouth. But it's not just Solomon's fame that draws her, is it? Look at that. The narrator's careful to point out his reputation was wrapped up with the name of the Lord, right there in verse 1. It can be tempting to read this whole chapter as a critique of luxurious living and spiritual decline. It can be tempting to read this whole chapter that way because we know where the story's going. In other words, we could bring to this chapter a foreshadowing framework because we know where the story's going, but that's actually not where it is right now. What draws the Queen of Sheba isn't anything untoward or illicit. It's the fame of Solomon and his Lord. But there's a second thing that attracts her attention, and it's apparently her love of competition. She came to test him with hard questions. How smart is this guy, really? I mean, she's never met a bro she couldn't best, right? This girl. The narrator doesn't make us wait long for the answer. Look at verse 3. Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he couldn't explain to her. Well, that was a pretty quick plot arc, right? She comes curious, and immediately the answer's the problem solved. Well, I pointed out that way because one of the things we talked about in these king's narratives is how complex they are. You've got a problem that's immediately solved, which means there's probably a different problem that drives this narrative. The presenting issue is solved right away. Yep, super smart. But the deeper spiritual issue remains. This queen has heard about the name of the Lord. Question is, will she come to see him? as the real glory of the kingdom. Well, let's see what happens. Verse 4. When the Queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house he had built, the food of his table, seating of his officials, the attendance of his servants and their clothing, his cupbearers, his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, there was no more breath in her. A list of seven glories in the kingdom. And I don't think it's a random list. It seems to be ordered in a way that draws parallels between Solomon's house and the house of the Lord. I mean, look, the two houses frame the list. End of verse 4, middle of verse 5. They frame the list. It starts with the house, and then it ends with the house of the Lord. And then the next item in, the food of his table and burnt offerings that he offered. I'm not saying it's a whole chiasm here, but there's just this sort of correspondence. In the middle, you've got officials and servants who sit and serve, and special clothing and cupbearers. It's language that at minimum evokes a picture of temple worship. The point being, Solomon's house seems to be a human replica of the divine house. Her attention's being deliberately drawn not just to Solomon, but to Solomon's God. And in case that little bit of structure work doesn't prove it, just listen to her own words. Verse 6. She said to the king, "The report was true, I heard in my own land of your words and your wisdom. But I didn't believe the reports till I came, and my own eyes had seen it. And behold, the half was not told me. Your wisdom and prosperity surpass the report I heard. Happy are your men. Happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Blessed be Yahweh your God," invoking the covenant name of Israel's God, "who has delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he's made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness." Such an important speech for understanding what she sees as the true treasure of the kingdom, right? She starts with Solomon. Your words, your wisdom, your prosperity, your men, your servants. But that's not where she ends, is it? She has seen that underneath and behind all of that is the hand, the presence, the blessing, the glory of the Lord himself. "Blessed be the Lord your God. He did this. His delight is in you. His love for Israel is over you. His standards of justice and righteousness are blessing you and causing your kingdom to flourish." Her words call back to the name of the Lord to the name from the Lord that Nathan gave Solomon. Remember that? Michael mentioned it in yesterday's sermon. When he was born, the Lord called him Jedidiah, loved by the Lord. The Queen of Sheba seems to see that. This is amazing grace from God to her and Solomon both, isn't it? For her, it's a moment of true spiritual illumination. She's seen through all the glitz and glamour to know what the real treasure of the kingdom is. The Torah predicted that God's blessing on Israel would work this way, didn't it? Deuteronomy chapter 28, verse 8. "The Lord will command blessing on you in your barns and all that you undertake. He will bless you in the land the Lord your God's giving you. He will establish you as a people holy to himself, as he's sworn, if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. And all the peoples of the earth will see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they'll be in awe of you." Bang, happening right here. Israel will flourish and Yahweh will be glorified. She's doing that. Amazing grace to her. But it's grace to Solomon as well, isn't it? She said these words to him. You just wonder if he's getting the point, right? Her questions about him have been answered. But our questions about him, they're just starting, aren't they? Her visit rounds off with an exchange of gifts, verse 10. She gave the king 120 talents of gold and a very great quantity of spices and precious stones. Never again came such an abundance of spices as these that the Queen of Sheba gave to King Solomon. Moreover, the fleet of Hiram, which brought gold from Ophir, brought from Ophir a very great amount of almug wood and precious stones, and the king made of the almug wood supports for the house of the Lord and for the king's house. Also lyres and harps for the singers. No such almug wood has come or been seen to this day. Verse 13 rounds off the queen's visit. And King Solomon gave to the queen of Sheba all that she desired, whatever she asked, besides what was given her by the bounty of the king of Solomon. So she turned and went back to her own land with her servants. It's a warm send-off in terms of the queen. But to me, the tilt of the chapter starts right here. Like verse 10, is there a note of sarcasm there? She gives three gifts, gold and a lot of it, 9,000 pounds of gold, spices and precious stones. But the narrator comments on just one of those three gifts. Imagine, right? He's recording this moment. 9,000 pounds of gold, a heap of precious stones over here, and spices in the middle, and he walks by and goes, oh, nice spices. Something is shifting in the kingdom. So the Queen of Sheba leaves satisfied, but our questions are just starting. Where is this guy's heart? Can he answer that for us? Yeah, he can. We don't have to wait for long. The narrator pretty clearly shows us the queen showed up and saw the treasure. The king who lived here doesn't. This chapter is marked by key words. The first half of the chapter is marked by the word wisdom, shows up four times in those 13 verses. The second half of the chapter is marked by the word gold, 10 times. That thing shows up. Right away, we're struck with it. Verse 14, now the weight of gold that came to Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Besides that which came from the explorers and the businesses of the merchants and from all the kings of the west and the governors of the land, King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went into each shield. He made 300 shields of beaten gold. 3 minas of gold went into each shield, and the king put them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. What we're starting to see is just an absolute portrait of luxury and exotica, stuff that doesn't serve any functional purpose, right? 25 tons of gold comes in this year. It's probably a good year, but 25 tons of gold, and notice what he does with it. It's not tax rebates. He pounds it into military defensive articles that aren't actually even useful because they're too soft. He just hangs them in the house of the forest of Lebanon. These are ceremonial use shields, serve no function whatsoever, except maybe to make the king's kingdom look amazing. And then the throne, verse 18, the king also made a great ivory throne, overlaid it with the finest gold. The throne had 6 steps. The throne had a round top. On each side of the seat were armrests, 2 lions standing beside the armrests, while 12 lions stood there, 1 on each end of a step on the 6 steps. The like of it was never made in any kingdom. This is a superlative throne, unmatched throughout anywhere in the realm or outside the realm. And there have been several statements like this as we've gone through the narrative. Nothing like that ever showed up before, but there's even a shift in how the superlative is framed. I mean, there were no spices like the Queen of Sheba's, but who gets to enjoy spices? Everybody who eats the meal. The almug wood shows up in verse 12, and there was no other wood as high quality as that. And it's used to build supports for the temple and instruments for the temple and some stuff in Solomon's house. But now the thing that is unlike anything else in the kingdom is just his. Verses 23 to 25 are really a summary of the entire chapter, at least from an external perspective. Thus King Solomon excelled all the kings of the earth in riches and in wisdom, and the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. Every one of them brought his present, articles of silver and gold, garments, myrrh, spices, horses, mules, so much year by year. It's a summary, right? I mean, you see. Riches, second half of the chapter. Wisdom, first half of the chapter. Verse 23 is the key word, or the key verse in the chapter. We've seen enough hints to know where this is going. I mean, I've already tipped my hand and told you, I think this is tilting into trouble. But there are two final clues to tip the narrator's hand that Solomon does not see or value what the king saw and valued. One of them is this puzzling thread that runs through the narrative about these ships. Did you notice I skipped those? So frustrating. One of the rules of structure is you can't just leave parts laying on the ground. The other one is the way that puzzling thread is just tied off tight at the end. So let me just show you. The puzzling thread is these ships of Hiram. They show up three times. Back in chapter 9 at the end, I had you read that. Then in chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, kind of inserted, almost like incoherently or in a way that doesn't relate, like a non sequitur, in the middle of the Queen of Sheba, not the middle, but before the Queen of Sheba part is rounded off, verses 11 and 12. And then I skipped it, but verses 21 and 22. Well, there's a progression that happens if you pay attention even to the ships. And I don't know for sure, but I wonder if those aren't sort of an index to the condition of Solomon's heart. At the end of chapter 9, the fleet, the ships show up there, and they mark the beginning of international commerce. It's Israel's first navy. They reach Ophir, the edge of the known world. They draw in the Queen of Sheba. It all seems innocent enough, and it probably is. In verses 11 and 12, the second time the ships show up, that commerce brings exotic materials that build the house of the Lord in Solomon's complex. It's notable, again, as I said, because of the way it interrupts the queen narrative. It's just shoved in there. There's nothing notable about the contents as such. But remember how I sort of pointed out what feels to me like sarcasm in verse 10? Pile of gold, pile of precious stones. Hey, nice spices. That's already happening here because what shows up on the ships is a bunch more precious stones. These luxury items are just becoming commonplace. And now look what happens in verses 21 and 22. The third time the ships appear, it's just outright decadent. All Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold. None were of silver. Silver wasn't considered as anything in the days of Solomon. For the king had a fleet of ships of Tarshish at sea with the fleet of Hiram. Once every 3 years, the fleet used to come bringing gold, silver, ivory, apes, and peacocks. This is just turning into a circus. It's just a show. No functional purpose. Doesn't help the Israelites at all. It's amazing, but it's gaudy. What began as covenantal blessing, the fame of Solomon and the Lord going to the nations, has turned now into self-indulgence. The glory that attracted the nations is now a glory that is corrupting the king himself. And I think the ships might mark that shift as it goes through the narrative. And in case that's not the point of the ships, the narrator ties off this chapter in a way that's emphatic and perfectly clear. This is full-on violation of the Torah, verse 26. Solomon gathered together chariots and horsemen, 1,400 chariots, 12,000 horsemen, whom he stationed at the chariot cities with the king in Jerusalem. And the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stone. He made cedar as plentiful as the sycamore of the Shephelah. And Solomon's import of horses was from Egypt and Kew, and the king's traders received them from Kew at a price. A chariot could be imported from Egypt for 600 shekels of silver, a horse for 150. And so through the king's traders, they were exported. What? They were exported? To all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. This is arms trade. He's not just accumulating horses and chariots. He's actually bringing them in, and now he has so many, he's actually making a profit off of them. And he's enriching kings that in a few years are going to afflict Israel. Good move, bro. It's hard to miss the allusion to Deuteronomy, isn't it? Chapter 17. Deuteronomy 17:15 and following lay down the principles for how a king is supposed to run his kingdom. The second half of the address to the king is he's supposed to write a copy of the law for himself. He's supposed to read it regularly. He's supposed to exemplify it for his brothers. But the first half of this code for the king is verses 15 to 17. You may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose, one among your brothers. Don't put a foreigner over you. Verse 16. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. Three things that are forbidden, right? Guns, girls, and guns. Did I say guns? Gold, girls, and guns. And look at chapter 11, verse 1. Now Solomon loved many foreign women. This sermon starts to preach itself at this point, doesn't it? Idolatry doesn't come as a bolt out of the blue. It grows from a subtle misordering of loves, from the glory of God to the glory of his gifts to the glory of the other gods. That's the progression. You see it right here. So what's the point of this whole narrative? If I had to put it in a nutshell, if I had to tell you what my answer to question 5 on the worksheet is, it's this, in one sentence. The greatest treasure of the kingdom is God. That's what the Queen of Sheba saw. That's what Solomon stopped seeing at some point. That the greatest treasure of the kingdom is God, brothers. That's the thing that if anyone is attracted to our work, kingdom, and if it's going to be legitimate, that must be the thing that draws them. If we are enjoying a period of blessing, that must be the thing, the treasure that is God. These exiles reading this chapter must have had that mixed reaction of, oh, that would have been amazing, and oh no, I can't believe we lost it. And let me just real quickly put a strong hope of the gospel in here related to this theme of treasure. Remember that parable that Jesus told in Matthew chapter 13 about the kingdom of heaven being like a treasure hidden in a field, and a man finds it, sells everything? That's a description of what's happened to you if you are in Christ. You have had something happen to you that is irreversible and irrevocable. You have found the treasure. You have given up everything to have Jesus. And that will never, I'm not saying that it will never change in you, that you won't ever be tempted to go after another treasure. But the conversion, to put a theological word on it, the conversion that's happened to you means we now see the world a whole new way and you are never going back. God has done something in you that cannot be undone. You are not entirely like Solomon when it comes to looking up treasure. You know that the greatest treasure of the kingdom is God. And so like the exiles, we receive the story and think, how did they get there? How can I avoid that? And there's a stronger hope for us than for them because of the gospel. But it's not just a story that we receive like exiles. It's a story that we actually inhabit. We start to identify with these characters, right? I wonder, which are you, the one who saw through all the pomp and glitter to recognize the greatest treasure of the kingdom, or the one who got distracted by all the gold and the glamour and God's gifts? And the gospel always turns up the volume on this stuff. When Jesus was talking to the Pharisees and religious leaders, he said to them, quoting, invoking this story with the Queen of Sheba, the Queen of the South will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it because she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here. Brothers, that's him. That's who we have. The greatest treasure of the kingdom is God, and we know his name. Jesus of Nazareth is the treasure, far greater than Solomon. And the Queen of Sheba saw it in a shadow, and we see it in full technicolor. So let me just make 3 quick applications, specific things that we should be doing in our own lives because of this passage. Number 1, beware your gifts. Beware your gifts. A lot of passages tell pastors to beware their weaknesses. This one calls us to beware maybe our strengths, the sources of blessing. God's gifts make wonderful blessings, and they make terrible gods. Don't start serving the prosperity of the kingdom. Or how about wisdom? One of the crazy things about this chapter is how subversive it is, how complicated it shows that sin is. Notice Solomon is never called a fool. It's his wisdom that is brought out at the very end in that sort of summary. Verse 24, the whole earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put into his mind. That's the thing that is so complicated about sin. Here's a wise man who fails precisely at the height of his wisdom. It'd be an easier passage to handle if it's just said, Solomon became a fool. But no, Solomon was functioning out of the gift God had given him, and that made him a fool because it turned him from the fear of the Lord wisdom to just shrewd getting by wisdom. Your gifts, brothers, can be the greatest danger to your ministry. Keeping your focus on God. I'm good at this thing. I can rock it, right? That's what's happening. It's just this subtle misordering of loves from the glory of God to the glory of the gifts to the glory of other gods, right? We saw that progression. So maybe here's an application. Don't envy the brothers who have greater gifts than you. Pray for them, right? It's a greater temptation, isn't it? Second application, love your people. All of this wealth flowing into the kingdom enriched Solomon. Chapter 4, we were just working on that. Chapter 4 shows that all of this wise administration blessed the people. They each sat under their own vine and fig tree, and all Israel was at peace. The people of the kingdom are conspicuously absent here in chapter 10. So brothers, if you're a good preacher, preach out of love for your people. Don't let the gift become the thing that draws your attention. Do this for them. Pray for them. Love the people. It seems like Solomon lost sight of that. And then the third quick application is fear the Lord. Solomon's wisdom had turned from real biblical fear of the Lord wisdom to some shrewd ability to just get by in life. The fear of the Lord, as I describe it to our church family, is just taking God seriously in all that he is. Tremble before him, bow, enjoy him, love him, run toward him, stand back and look at him in awe, in every way fear the Lord. Why? Because the greatest gift of the kingdom is God. Father, I pray that you would open our eyes all over again to what happened to us at conversion, to see the treasure hidden in the field that's worth selling everything to have. I pray that this sweet and powerful passage would call brothers back from complacency, from familiarity, from an unhealthy obsession with the blessings of ministry and the gifts they've been given. And please, in your mercy, open our eyes to the beauty of Christ, so much greater than Solomon. In his name I pray.